they're going to be in a world of trouble because somebody will almost certainly bring a lawsuit that says you can't pay out a dividend out of the principal.
Debating whether to pay out a permanent fund dividend this year. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 8th of January. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, predictions for easing temperatures across much of the state.
You know, these cold snaps eventually end, and this one is rapidly approaching its end.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Well, all of us are applying for our permanent fund dividends and wondering how large the checks will be in October. Legislators and analysts are working over the question of whether there will be any dividend at all. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The permanent fund takes its share of the state's revenue, invests it, saves it, and gives the legislature the profits on those investments. Under the Constitution, there's no way for any state entity to use the fund's direct income for any purpose. The profits or earnings are available for the legislature to spend, but so far, the only money to go out is what's been paid to Alaskans as dividends. $2,069 per person last year, and that's what's at risk this year. The permanent fund has lost money. Investments have fallen so much that there are no earnings left. Since the legislature can't spend the fund's revenue income, it doesn't have any money for dividends. The House and Senate Finance Committees will hold hearings on the issue during the opening days of the session. Juno economist Greg Erickson has studied and written on the subject. He says there are two interpretations of the formula that determines the earnings of the fund. And that's where the controversy arises.
The traditional view would be that there isn't any money available for appropriation now because the permanent fund is underwater. Some of the money that we put in the bank has been lost in investment losses, and there weren't enough reserves to cover those losses, so it's dipped into the principal. Principal's worth less now than we put in.
The permanent fund, however, reports an earnings reserve of more than $4 billion. That's based on an accounting method authorized in 2003 by then-Attorney General Greg Rinkus. That method takes investment losses from the principal, not from previously earned profits. And it makes previous earnings available while the value of the fund goes down. Erickson doesn't advocate either side or any action, but he says the question needs to be answered before a problem develops.
If the market's still down and if the permanent fund is still underwater, in 5 months, 6 months, they're going to be in a world of trouble because somebody will almost certainly bring a lawsuit that says you can't pay out a dividend out of the principal. That's not what we voted this amendment for. This money was supposed to be kept in perpetuity, and if you had a lot of losses on investments, that's tough. You can't dip into the principal to make it look like it's okay.
The Permanent Fund's Executive Director, Mike Burns, says it's not up to the fund's managers to make a decision on the subject. They've asked the current Attorney General for a new opinion on the accounting methods. But until they hear differently, they'll follow the 2003 instructions. He says the fund's practices have been audited yearly since the current method went into place, and there have been no problems. Burns says he doesn't see any need for immediate change.
I'm a lot more concerned about the markets turning around and getting the capital markets, you know, healthier and the whole economy healthier than the potential, I guess, for litigation on this, if that will have a life of its own. But the legal professionals at this point and the accounting professionals support that this is the correct definition of the earnings reserve and have for a number of years.
House Finance Co-Chairman Mike Hawker and Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman will have the subject up for discussion. Stedman says the public shouldn't jump to any conclusion on the controversy, and Hawker says it's an important issue to put before the public because it's setting up to be a potential legal problem.
You know, it's one of those that I'd much rather deal with
an open public environment, presenting both sides of the case and hopefully arriving at a legally sound conclusion that avoids a litigatory situation this year.
Erickson said the situation might not develop. The dividend to Alaskans could be paid from another source, such as the state's general fund. Or the markets could turn around enough to give the fund a profit by both accounting methods. He says that would make the current concern only an academic exercise. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Former State Representative Bruce Weirach plans to appeal his corruption case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Weirach was originally scheduled to go to trial in September, but U.S. District Court Judge John Sedgwick ruled that the evidence relating to the state ethics violations could not be used in the trial. Prosecutors appealed, and in November, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court reversed Sedgwick's opinion and said the evidence could be submitted. The court said federal law applies to every public official, and the government does not need to prove an independent violation of state law. Weirach's request for a rehearing before the Ninth Circuit Court was denied yesterday. The Juneau Republican was indicted in 2007 for using U.S. mail to solicit a job from VECO while the legislature was considering oil tax legislation. Federal prosecutors allege Weirach voted at the direction of VECO while he was negotiating future legal service with the company, thereby denying the state his honest services. His lawyer, Doug Pope, calls the case extremely weak.
In this case, the question is, what is a breach of the duty of honest services mean? And the Ninth Circuit and these other circuits that are like them have decided that, well, that means we get to make up, we federal judges get to make up rules about the ethical behavior of public officials who are state and local officials. I don't think it means that. What it would result in is a federal judge instructing a federal jury on what the rules of an Alaska House of Representatives are in order to determine whether a member of the Alaska House of Representatives should be convicted of mail fraud.
Pope says he's always thought the case could only be won before the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's never been a question of if the court will take the issue, but when.
We always thought that it was an issue that the U.S. Supreme Court would be more inclined to grant definitive relief on, because my impression is that all of the circuits, the Ninth Circuit now, and these other circuits that have gone the way of the Ninth Circuit, are really too far out in front of the U.S. Supreme Court on the interpretation of the mail fraud statute.
Pope says he has associated with a Washington, D.C. law firm and expects to file the case in the next couple of months. Though the U.S. Supreme Court gets hundreds, sometimes thousands of appeals every year, it usually agrees to hear only about 100 of those cases. The final day of racing at the U.S. Cross Country Ski Championships in Anchorage went ahead today. Half the races had to be canceled this week because of abnormally cold temperatures. But the men's and women's 1.5-kilometer classic sprint went ahead this afternoon. Event finals were scheduled for this evening. Anchorage-based skier and U.S. ski team member Keegan Randall is competing. The sprint is generally considered her best event. The National Weather Service is predicting an end to the cold snap. Meteorologist Bob Fisher in Fairbanks says warmer temperatures and clouds from the Gulf of Alaska will move in the coming days.
We're like a pineapple express. It's a big shift in the upper air pattern, which we haven't seen for about 2 weeks. And, you know, these cold snaps eventually end, and this one is rapidly approaching its end.
Fisher says temperatures will remain cold today and tomorrow, with lows down to 50 below in interior valleys. But then it will begin to moderate over the weekend.
Small smidgen of warming Saturday and Sunday, and then probably a lot of warming Monday as we get a brief Chinook coming in through the area. That should warm temperatures up to more reasonable wintertime levels, to near normal. And then by Wednesday or Thursday, there's a good likelihood of some temperatures up in the hills getting above freezing.
Fisher says the shift from the extreme cold that's dominated Alaska's weather since just after Christmas is not expected to bring any significant precipitation to the interior. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Congress gets a lesson in climate change.
We're actually not going to have global warming. We're going to have global weirding. The weather gets weird. The hots get hotter. The dries get longer. The wets get heavier.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
Senator Lisa Murkowski took her seat for the first time today as the Energy and Natural Resources Committee's top Republican. From Washington, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Senator Murkowski's status as ranking member won't be official until the Senate approves its appointments resolution, but it's considered to be a lock. After only 6 years in the Senate, Murkowski rose to be her party's leader on the committee when Pete Domenici of New Mexico retired last month. Democrat Jeff Bingaman chairs the group since his party is in power, but Murkowski sits beside him and has the privilege of speaking for her party. The Energy Committee's first hearing of the new Congress looked at the energy security challenges facing the country. Murkowski says she knows the nation's focus and that of Congress is on the economic crisis, but she says there's an important connection between the economy and energy policy.
We can't begin to fix the economy without addressing the need to how we're going to run our factories, how we're going to power our cars, how we're going to heat our homes. And while we have seen lower gas prices that have provided some relief, we recognize that it's only temporary until we can find a long-term solution to our nation's dependence on foreign energy sources.
The issue of energy security and independence is likely to be a major focus of Murkowski's next 2 years in office.
We've got to find ways to power our lives that are cleaner, that are more efficient, and, of course, more environmentally protective.
Murkowski noted that energy bills the committee led passage of in recent years haven't been fully implemented by federal agencies, and she pointed to offshore wind projects as an example. Some parts of the bills haven't yet received appropriations funding, but Murkowski says they will now likely be funded by the economic stimulus package that's being discussed in Washington.
The stimulus package, which is under development, will likely fund a number of these existing authorizations, everything from making our electrical grid smarter to increasing R&D work on alternative technologies to providing energy efficiency block grants to schools and local communities.
The Energy Committee took testimony Thursday from people who represent the Chamber of Commerce, the Energy Security Leadership Council, which is a group of business and military leaders, the Western Governors Association, and the progressive think tank, the Center for American Progress, or CAP. Kit Batten with CAP says her organization believes green investment is the path to energy security and economic prosperity.
CAP recently released a report detailing how a $100 billion investment in clean energy and efficiency over 2 years would create 2 million jobs, nearly four times as many jobs as a similar level of investment in oil and gas.
There was disagreement among those testifying about how much effort should go toward drilling untapped oil, especially in controversial shale bed areas. But everyone agreed that renewable projects and energy conservation must be components of a new American energy plan. Diane Nielsen with the Western Governors Association says her group has some immediate short-term goals.
Promoting energy efficiency in all forms, including manufacturing of more fuel-efficient vehicles, enhancing public transportation systems, adopting regulatory structures that reward utilities that achieve reduced energy use among their customers, and manufacturing more efficient consumer goods.
Energy Committee members say they'll take all of Thursday's testimony into account as they craft new legislation in the coming months. The congressional session is off to a fast and focused start. The committee meets next week to hold confirmation hearings for Energy Secretary nominee Stephen Chu and Interior Secretary nominee Senator Ken Salazar, who has sat on the Energy Committee. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Concerns about energy security and its connection to the economic crisis are reverberating through Washington. Not only is the Energy Committee talking about how to make the country more energy independent and efficient, but yesterday the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee held a briefing about how green technology can help the country's economic recovery. Committee Chair is Senator Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California. She warned that the country is at a crisis point in the midst of a recession and facing the threat of global warming. But she said the two can be tackled together for the benefit of all Americans.
The good news is when we take steps to combat global warming, we create jobs, we'll become more energy independent, we'll reinvigorate our economy. All this is such a wonderful plus. A lot of times you have a problem and the cure is really not, it's tough at the end of the day. But this is a cure that is going to make us stronger at the end of the day.
One of the guests testifying before the committee was author and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. His latest book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, dissects the problems of global warming and overpopulation. Friedman says all over the country, people are coming up with innovative ways to save energy. But he says Washington is stalled.
The country is alive with innovation and experimentation around the energy environment issue. But if I were to draw a picture of America today, it'd be a picture really of the space shuttle taking off. You know, all this incredible thrust coming from below. But in our case, the booster rocket. Washington, D.C. has been cracked and leaking energy. And the pilots in the cockpit are still fighting over the flight plan. And as a result, we as a country cannot achieve escape velocity on this issue to get into the next orbit, the next great industrial revolution, which I call ET, energy technology.
Friedman recommends carbon or gas taxes or a cap and trade system. Also testifying today was John Doerr, a venture capitalist who has helped launch major companies, including Google. He also invests in green technologies and says the federal government can easily encourage local communities and individuals to start green power projects. He told Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar that the biggest point of leverage is through regulating the utilities.
If we got the utilities to be rewarded for feed-in tariffs, which is what they have in Germany, or net metering, which some states have done, which says if you generate wind more than you need your power, you can sell it back to the grid.
You can get a credit back to it because you're giving it back to the grid.
And let me tell you, those citizens love to see their utility meter run backwards. You don't have to lay out a single dollar of federal money to do that.
Only one utility in Alaska buys renewable power from its members, Golden Valley Electric Association in the Fairbanks area. Its customers can volunteer to pay more in their monthly bills to contribute towards buying renewable power from local producers. Wasilla High School went into lockdown this morning after the school received a threat. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
According to Catherine Essery, public information officer for the Matanuska-Susitna School District, the lockdown arose from two very cryptic notes.
The principal had received two pieces of paper, one last night, one this morning. One piece said bomb, and then the next piece said bomb and had a time on it.
The Wasilla police were called, and the chief recommended bringing in bomb-sniffing dogs from Fort Richardson. The dogs began a day-long sweep of the building.
Students were in a lockdown and were safe all day. They were in their classrooms. We moved them from different parts of the building when the bomb squad dogs were in the hallways.
Essery says the lockdown was essentially called to keep the students and staff from interfering with the dog's search. The two notes were apparently written on one of the school's computers students can use. Because the notes were almost certainly a hoax, the students were not evacuated.
We did not feel that it was at the highest escalation of threat, but we took it seriously, so we wanted to do a lockdown to make sure kids were safe.
Students were allowed to text or call their parents, and if parents wanted to, they could come and get their kids. Essery says most of the students felt safe enough to carry on the day. Hoax or not, the Matsu School District is responding in a serious fashion. Its technical staff is examining the school computers, and Essery says the district is already offering a $500 reward to anyone who has information leading to the apprehension of the note writer. Anonymity is guaranteed, she said. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, recently released new data on job creation and sales generation by the commercial and recreational fishing industries. Alaska does not rank number one. Of the $103 billion in commercial fishery sales for 2006, the year data was compiled, only $3 billion came from Alaska. Alaska ranked ninth overall for job creation with 40,000 jobs. California ranked number one with nearly $10 billion in sales and almost 180,000 jobs. NOAA economist Rita Curtis explains that the data was produced by a computer model that includes not only harvesting and processing jobs, but also retail sector jobs such as in seafood restaurants and grocery stores, and includes the ripple effect from all those jobs.
The ripple effect is we're not just looking at the jobs in the retail sector, but it's also the jobs that are generated from those employees that then go out and they make other sales and they demand other services. So they go out and pay their mortgage, they go out for dinner, they do all of these activities, and those support additional jobs. And so the software is able to account for how those dollars get allocated throughout the economy and come up with this total number.
When all of those factors are taken into account, Curtis says Alaska doesn't have large enough population centers to create very many jobs or revenue.
However, if you just looked at the commercial harvest sector and the seafood processor and seafood dealers, just those subcomponents of the fishing industry, you'll see that Alaska is number one across the board.
The state is also number one for landing revenue, and Alaska is the only state where the commercial fishing industry is the number one private employer. Curtis says the information is used by industries, governments, and individuals to understand the importance of fishing in their communities and to assess the damage done after natural disasters such as hurricanes. The Alaska Board of Fisheries has rescheduled its consideration of a controversial proposal that would limit the fishing effort in the Upper Cook Inlet Central District salmon fishery. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
The board will now consider Proposal 379 in 2011, the next time it meets to consider Cook Inlet issues. It was previously scheduled to be heard in March at a meeting focusing mostly on Prince William Sound and Southeast Alaska fisheries. The proposal would shut down the Central District for 2 weeks at the end of July, no matter how the run is shaping up. The idea is to get more salmon into the Northern District of Cook Inlet, where sport fishermen have complained about a lack of fish. Commercial fishermen oppose the idea, and Drew Sparlin, president of the United Cook Inlet Drift Association, says he's glad the board decided to put the issue off for 2 years.
Well, I think it's certainly appropriate, and I am happy that they made the decision to take it to and place it on to the full cycle whenever the Cook Inlet issue is on and before the board.
The proposal was submitted by Board of Fisheries member Howard Delo of Big Lake near Wasilla. Sparlin says he didn't like the way Delo got it on the agenda for the meeting this March.
It was very unusual, and it certainly was something that was different from anything that we've seen in the past, because it just wasn't quite the appropriate way to do things.
Steve Vanek, a commercial fisherman from Ninilchik, calls the proposal an ugly situation and says Delo is just trying to satisfy the sport fishing interests in the Mat-Su area.
Yeah, in my opinion, it's not. It was just a political ploy by Howard Delo's for his purposes.
The Board of Fisheries released a statement saying the move would ensure that the proposal has more exposure for public review and comment, and that it would best be considered in the context of other Cook Inlet proposals. Sparlin says he thinks the move means it's less likely that the proposal will be approved.
Oh, I think without a doubt they're going to get much better information both from the public and from the department.
The board hasn't scheduled its next meeting on Cook Inlet issues, but if it follows the cycle from previous years, it should take place sometime in February of 2011. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
A proposed change to fish and game regulations would offer new protections to white-colored black bears near Skagway. A so-called glacier bear was killed in the area last summer. From member station KHNS in Haines, John Hunt reports.
The white-faced or partially white-colored black bear was killed last June, despite the fact that the community had persuaded the State Board of Game in November 2007 to pass a regulation against its harvest. Regulations to protect individual animals are not unheard of in Alaska. Another white-colored bear in the Juneau area and a white moose in the interior have similar regulations. Many community members were angry after this regulation, which was based on those other cases and with input from state fish and game wildlife biologists, failed to protect the bear. ADF&G was ultimately powerless to punish the hunter. An effort to rephrase the regulation was begun at a public meeting in Skagway last July. Over 60 people attended that meeting. Local resident John Warder worked on the changes to the latest draft. Tim Borsi, who was mayor of Skagway when the original regulation was considered, is still involved in the issue and attended the latest Board of Game meeting last November.
I'm just trying to get something that's enforceable because, really what happened was a travesty of policy and enforcement.
Borsi suggested the white-faced bear in Skagway be referred to as a glacier bear, which broadens the description. Last June's death of Skagway's spirit bear is still officially unconfirmed. But another reason to continue the effort in the rewording of the regulation has been reported. Borsi, who has a history in wildlife biology, explains.
There is another glacier bear in the valley. Even though that white bear was taken, I believe the sow had another batch of cubs and had another white-faced black bear.
Borsi stressed the importance that the issue gathers input from different viewpoints within Skagway.
This is not a we don't want people to hunt issue. It's, we would like to protect a certain rare, occurring bear. That's what it is.
The bear shot last June was on private land and was considered a threat to personal property. The regulation up for consideration, even if the wording is changed to protect a glacier bear, would not change a homeowner's right to protection. Representatives from ADF&G's Division of Wildlife Conservation are hosting the informal public meeting this Saturday at 5:30 p.m. in Skagway's Convention and Visitors Bureau. Reporting in Haines, I'm John Hunt.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Casey Kelly in Homer, and John Hunt in Haines. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and David Waldron. John Proffitt is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.